I'm Bonnie Glaser, director of the Asia Program at the German Marshall Fund of the United States. In this episode of China Global, we're going to discuss China in 2022. We'll talk about key events on Beijing's political calendar and what we should expect in China's domestic and foreign policy this year. The Beijing Olympics will be held next month, and China faces both the challenge of COVID-19 spreading to several Chinese cities and growing criticism of its policy in Xinjiang, which has led some countries, including the United States, to declare diplomatic boycotts. The National People's Congress will be held in March, with important implications for China's economic policy, among other issues. Personnel rotations around the country are already beginning to take place and will continue throughout the year as the Chinese Communist Party makes preparations for the all-important National Party Congress slated for the fall. Apart from bestowing a third five-year term in power to Xi Jinping, what else should we expect from the upcoming Party Congress? To analyze the key developments of 2022 and their implications, I'm delighted to have as my guest today Jude Blanchett. Jude holds the Freeman Chair in China Studies at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. His first book is China's New Red Guards, The Return of Radicalism and the Rebirth of Mao Zedong. Thank you so much for joining us today, Jude.
Thank you very much, Bonnie. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Well, there's a lot to discuss, so let's just dig in. The Winter Olympics will begin on February 4th after months of international controversy and obviously domestic concerns over the impacts of COVID-19, as it seems like every day another Chinese city has cases of the virus. So I'm curious if you think the Olympics will be a success for Xi Jinping that will advance his goals domestically and internationally. Or is this really risky for him? And could he pay a price? And what do you think China's goals are in holding these Olympics?
That's a great question. And I think there's, you'd probably have to disaggregate it because to some extent, given that the games were awarded to Beijing 6 years ago, Xi Jinping has already enjoyed some benefits from the games simply by getting them. And, you know, it's important to remember that these games are often seen or act as legitimators for authoritarian regimes. That's why countries often crave getting the games. And it also sends a signal to the domestic audience that a given country, in this case China, is a truly international, a global power. That being said, and as your question intimated, I would imagine at this moment, Xi Jinping is looking at the games with a bit of trepidation as he's seeing Omicron march steadily closer to the capital. And as you said, we now have that single case in the city. We have cases in Tianjin. And given both the heightened sensitivities for Beijing about how the Omicron might interfere, and more importantly, given that for Beijing, the successful conquest over COVID has been a key legitimating narrative for the party on why its governance system is superior to Western alternatives, I think they're likely very nervous about that. That being said, they've got everything in a very tight bubble. The games are going to go ahead. I think in terms of ultimate success or not, I was there for 2008 in Beijing. This is just a very, very different games. It has none of the domestic pomp and circumstance. Remember that tired phrase in 2008 about it being China's coming out party? There was a sense of optimism and awe about China. And now I think it's fitting that these are the winter games. It's cold. The sun sets quite late. And I think this is just a very, very different time for Beijing. So the real benefit for Beijing was 2008. I think there's really only marginal benefit at this point. So the games will go off. I think they'll contain COVID. And then the hard work gets done as soon as they get through the games. And it's starting to tackle all of these challenges about pivoting away from zero COVID, as you mentioned, planning the 20th Party Congress. So this is almost the easiest thing Xi Jinping has to deal with this year.
I understand you've heard a little bit about the preparation for the games. Is there anything that you can share on what you think the opening ceremonies will show us? Is this going to be another display of Chinese history and culture and stoking Chinese nationalism? Or is the tone going to be and the message very different?
From what I heard, and this is why eating humble pie is very important doing China work, because this is very different from what I would assume. A few folks who have seen portions and all of the practice said it was totally devoid of any concrete historical national narratives. It was this kind of abstract celebration of, you know, tea and flowers and just really as if Xi Jinping had either determined that this was not the time for some great celebration, or, and this is interesting, maybe is starting to understand that some of the real triumphal nationalism is energizing pushback globally. I don't know, but I think I would have guessed that really in this time she would have come out with a full-fledged nationalist cultural display, but apparently not.
So let's move on and talk about the National People's Congress, the CPCCC, of course known as the Lianghui, the two meetings. And those will start pretty much right after the Olympics and the Paralympics close. So that will start on March 5th. Can you give us an overview of what you think some of the most important topics that will be addressed in the NPC? Is there any potential legislation that you think could emerge from the Congress? And what are the domestic political dynamics behind the scenes in this NPC?
Yeah, maybe first point to make is the Lianghui, but really the NPC meeting more than the CPPCC meeting has, I think, become much more important since the 19th Party Congress in 2017. I think most of us were really surprised at the 2018 NPC meeting where they out of the blue announced this extraordinary political restructuring plan and, of course, the amendments to the PRC constitution to get rid of term limits. I only say that as a baseline to say we can clearly be surprised by an NPC meeting nowadays. So that's the first point. Second is the big thing to watch at the NPC will be how they're thinking about economic growth and the target for the year. We just got the new economic numbers out from the National Bureau of Statistics, and it's not looking good. You know, China grew at 8.1% for the year, which sounds great. That's way above the target. But really, most of that growth came in the first half. And then you look at the second half, including the final quarter, growth is really starting to sink. And so many would have expected in previous times that given this is a party Congress year, we're going to see a lot of priming and goosing of growth to get through. But I think something more interesting is going to happen at the MPC. They're clearly going to try to stabilize growth, as has been the watchword over the past month or so of stability, stability, stability. But they're also very worried about sort of overinflating the economy. So I think we're going to see at the MPC meeting, we'll see what they're going to do for the annual growth target, which has been more flexible as of late. In terms of the legislative agenda, all we really know at this point is the readout from the last MPC, National People's Congress Standing Committee, where they mentioned that there was going to be another draft of this so-called organic law of local people's congresses and local governments. That's basically just a subnational rejigging of election processes. And then they mentioned there were going to be two draft policies on how Hong Kong and Macau elect deputies to the 14th MPC. The only other clue we would have is looking at outstanding legislation on the MPC Standing Committee docket, which is open for draft. There's interesting stuff, but probably not too, you know, important. There's some stuff on vocational education. There's something on the emergency response and management law. But as it looks now, there don't appear to be anything like we had over the past few years, whether that was the Hong Kong National Security Law. We don't see anything really outstanding at this moment.
Last year, there were some rumors that there could be revisions of the 2005 anti-secession law for Taiwan and perhaps even a national reunification law. Think that we would see anything surprising on Taiwan this year?
On some of these bigger pieces of legislation, this close to an NPC meeting, you do start to get more concrete hints that this is moving through. The only stuff that I've seen on the Taiwan community in Beijing that's interesting is not about any big piece of legislation or amendment of it, but more about expectation that this is going to be a pretty contentious year with PLA, more PLA activity in the Taiwan Strait. But again, surprises are always possible, but usually it's hard to move big pieces of legislation or amendments through without some of that coming, leaking out, even in Xi Jinping's China.
It seems to me that two of the really prominent themes now are security and self-sufficiency. And it just seems to apply to everything. It's food security, so agriculture, technology, energy. What do you think that's going to mean in practice this year? Anything that we will see that will really try to advance those agendas?
You're seeing a whole host of knock-on plans that are still coming out from the 14th five-year plan. So we're still moving through the industries. We just have one on the digital economy, which came out of CAC. So you are really seeing the imprint of this national security worldview on how big industry level documents are being formulated. And of course, that has important knock-on effects for implementation. And I think self-sufficiency is really just flip side of the national security coin. The two concepts are intertwined with, I think, Beijing making the very accurate assessment that the international environment is becoming more, is scrutinizing China more, that there are active efforts by countries. This is not just the United States. This is Japan. This is Australia, to think about shifting away from reliance on Beijing for key components and utilizing regulatory and legislative powers to be able to make it more difficult for China to gain access for critical components. So there is a, I think there's a justified logic behind why Beijing is saying we need to indigenize and onshore. The problem is going to be that with Xi Jinping, I think they're really moving in a direction of too much too fast. And I think we're already seeing this show up in some of the economic softening. So I think the real risk moving forward is I don't see Xi Jinping finding a Goldilocks point on this drive for national security and self-reliance. It's clear this is going to be the dominant shaper of policy in China through the rest of the decade.
Well, before we get into sort of more domestic politics and the party Congress, I want to ask you a foreign policy question. It's interesting to me that there's definitely emerged, I think, a consensus amongst many observers of Chinese foreign policy that we're going to see a more assertive foreign policy after Xi Jinping gets his third term. But that has led some people to conclude that this year, because Xi Jinping needs stability and maybe a better relationship with countries around the world, implying that maybe he's recognized that there's a problem in China's foreign relations, which is a question mark. But a lot of people seem to think that we're going to see a more moderate Chinese foreign policy this year. And I want to hear your views on whether you agree with that.
I think if people think that this is a year that we can push Xi Jinping, I would say be very, very careful. I think, yes, clearly, I think in terms of Xi Jinping's own decided escalations on, let's say, the border region in India. Yeah, I would expect he is largely going to want to avoid provoking a fight. The flip side of that, though, is I can imagine Xi Jinping's nationalist sensitivities are going to be cranked up to 15 this year. And so I think, you know, we don't typically think of Xi Jinping having to run for office. And I think that's true, but it's also, Xi Jinping is going to be very, very active in ensuring that he is not painted in a bad light, that he is not seen to be sort of allowing other powers to ride roughshod. So I think all of the big areas where we're seeing potential flashpoints or frictions, whether that's Taiwan, U.S.-China relations, I think we need to be very considerate and thoughtful in terms of the policies that we want to push. Where I do think there's space is probably in areas of Xi Jinping's, you know, the periphery of his sight, where he probably is going to say, you know, I've got to focus attention on domestic politics first and core areas second. So you can imagine, you know, peripheral issues where, sure, I would imagine we have more of a free hand this year because Xi Jinping may well decide he's got bigger fish to fry. But as I think was in the way you worded the question, you were probably on the same page that, yes, I think it's true. Foreign policy is going to get more proactive and risk tolerant after the 20th Party Congress. But I think there's an extraordinary amount of sensitivity this year that I'd be wary of.
I do agree. I think on sovereignty issues, this is a time where Xi Jinping is not going to want to look weak and potentially be vulnerable in a way that people could take advantage of him. Okay, let's talk a little bit about personnel rotations and jockeying in advance of the upcoming 20th Party Congress. What are we seeing? What should we be looking for?
This is going to be, I mean, this is extraordinary because we're focused so much on Xi Jinping, and that makes total sense. But of course, we're going to see one of the largest turnovers in the entire military bureaucratic political system that we've seen in decades. And if you think about the behavior of a large bureaucratic state like China as not just the sum of Xi Jinping, but as the aggregate of all of the actors within the system, I mean, this is really just such an interesting question mark for what the system, how it behaves after the 20th Party Congress. This starts at the very apex of power with the Standing Committee and the Politburo, right? Where we do, and here's another big question mark, depending on if age limits hold. Or not. I mean, that we could see half the Politburo leave. We could see less than half than the Politburo leave. This is the new era of Xi Jinping, where, as we've seen with individuals like Wang Qishan, who is a, you know, honorary member of the Standing Committee, even though he shouldn't be. He's got no, he shouldn't be in those meetings. And Xi Jinping himself will stay on after the you know, sort of norm of age retirement that is held in place for the past several party congresses. So it starts at the very top, but this moves throughout the entire central committee. And then, of course, at the senior leadership of the PLA, we're likely going to see a massive, massive handover in power. And as you mentioned at the top of this, you're already seeing the energy around those promotions or demotions start to actuate itself now in the way that the political system is moving with, I think, increased energy here. So, you know, just I think for me, the big takeaway is potentially massive, massive turnover. And really, we need to be expecting that that the political system after the 20th Party Congress is going to see, I think, a bit of time of readjustment as you have all these new personnel settling in. And then I think we really have to keep our eye laser-like on trying to figure out how this new significant rotation is going to affect the behavior of the political state. And one final point, which is all but certain, all of the senior level promotions are going to be Xi Jinping's guys. And so this is the problem with personalized dictatorships. The longer a dictator stays in power, the more the system conforms to his whims. And so this is really troubling territory. And if we were expecting, you know, moderation from Xi and the political system, I think you've got some of the structural problems going to get even worse about how much good information is Xi Jinping getting, who's knocking on his door to tell him he's full of BS and we need to shift away from that. I think that space is diminishing.
One of these scenarios that some experts have talked about is the possibility of Xi Jinping taking the title party chairman, which hasn't been used since Mao Zedong's era. That if he resurrects this title, he could leave open the position of party general secretary and begin to groom an heir designate, or he could even appoint a deputy party chairman. Does that scenario make sense to you?
No, but let me just caveat that by saying, you know, who knows? Let me just to lay out my reasoning. Number one, the title of party chairman, you know, left and was abolished in 1982 because of how strongly it was identified with the Mao era. And so Deng Xiaoping at the time, in addition to putting term limits on the office of the presidency in 1982, also abolished the title of party chairman because the clear message was, we're not going back to the Mao era. That history is not very long ago. It would be extraordinary to me that Xi Jinping would want to say essentially, I'm Mao. And I don't think we see really any other part of that in his behavior. And so that would be a risky move. Second, and this is the one I struggle with even more, I don't think the title of general secretary has been very constraining for Xi Jinping. I don't see this as if he needs a new title to be able to really expand into power. And on the issue of succession, he can name successors. Xi Jinping was a known successor before he was general secretary. So there is a path here which we could see. And indeed, I think we may well see at this party Congress, two or more individuals emerge who broadly fit the pattern in terms of age and experience. And then Xi Jinping can spend the next 5 or 10 years running them through the mill in a way to essentially look as if he's grooming them for power. That's what happened to Hu Jintao. That's what happened to Xi Jinping, who, along with Li Keqiang, was well before even the 17th Party Congress known to be a possible successor. So, you know, in short, I don't see the real need for him to do this, but I'm wrong often, so.
You are too modest. But some people make the argument that when a leader in China identifies an heir apparent, that their power and position begin to wane almost immediately. Now, maybe that wouldn't happen if it wasn't so clear because there are two or three possible people, but some people have said that would constrain him from doing so. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, that's the old sort of crown prince dilemma. Definitely, right? You can imagine this happens, by the way, in electoral politics. I remember Terry Branstad once telling me that he recognized Xi's strategy because he never wanted a lieutenant governor, which was going to outshine him when he was governor. So absolutely. But I think, first of all, if he does announce successors, these are going to be his own people, and they're not going to be anyone who he has identified with posing any sort of a risk. The other thing is, I think it would be functionally very, very difficult for Chunmin Ar, for example, to pose a credible threat to Xi Jinping and put him in sort of lame duck position, given how extraordinarily powerful Xi Jinping is. So just in short, yes, I can see a little bit of logic there, but the risk he would be taking to bring on take the office of the party chairman seems like a lot of potential, you know, risk for something that he could probably mitigate, given how powerful he is.
And do you think that the Politburo Standing Committee will remain the same size? Any possibility of going back to 9? I doubt it would get any smaller, but what do you think?
Same thing, where you just try to think of to what problem would he be trying to solve with adjusting the numbers, right? So we've seen a standing committee go down to 5. We've seen it up to 11. But I just try to think, okay, what does adding a few other members get you? It's not like there's a concentrated policy portfolios amongst the 7 right now that he would want to diffuse. The only possible, you know, way in tying this to the succession issue is if he wanted to bring on a few folks to the standing committee who looked successor-ish, in addition to a trusted group that he remade with the standing committee, and so he wants to adjust the number up. I think the big point in the standing committee nowadays is it just doesn't matter as much. You know, we don't look at it like we did with the 17th Party Congress, the 18th Party Congress, the 16th Party Congress, where it told you who is going to own a given policy vertical, and it was where you were really sort of reading the tea leaves for succession. There's one position that matters in the standing committee now, and that's general secretary.
So let's talk a little bit about the political report. I remember at the 19th Party Congress, you know, the watchword was Xin Shi Dai, the new era, and everything was about the new era. And I think one of the really memorable things about that political report was the setting of targets for 2035 and 2049. So what do you think might pop up in the new political report? Will there be any new political concepts or policies that we should be looking for?
If we think about these work reports as kind of building on each other and adapting to what's transpired in the last 5 years, I think you're right. So we've seen the framing of what we've seen more clear articulation of the goals for 2035 and 2049. I almost wonder if a lot of the focus on the next work report is really about the next sort of 10 years to get there. I think it's also where we're going to see a pretty clear idea of how long Xi Jinping is going to remain in power. I think it's where we're going to see two policies in particular, I think, receive some attention, and that's going to be the new development framework, which is several years old now, but you're seeing with increasing regularity crop up. And that's really the big macroeconomic strategy that governs domestic politics. I think that's going to receive some increased focus. And then I think common prosperity, less as a very coherent specific blueprint of what to do, because already they're backing off of the common prosperity. They're basically letting everyone know, no, this is a long-term goal. Don't worry, we're not going to kill rich people. You're still going to be able to get rich. But I think it's an important plank because it speaks to Xi's understanding of some of the qualitative challenges of growth and some of the growing populist tensions within the country about how the fruits of growth are distributed. So I think you're going to see both further focus on the sort of the elements of technological power. I think you're going to see more focus on and on the sort of populist social elements that common prosperity provides a nice framework to discuss. And of course, that builds upon the shift in the principal contradiction at the 19th Party Congress to how we distribute the pie rather than just making the pie bigger.
I've always thought that the assessment of the international situation is that China makes is really important in shaping their foreign policy. So I wonder if you think there'll be anything different. We've pretty much seen Xi Jinping talk about the international situation as containing risks for China, but yet emphasizing the positive developments. And we have, of course, seen this phrase being repeated frequently, the East is rising, the West is declining. So do you think that's sort of the characterization we'll see about the description of the international situation? Or do you think maybe we'll see it more positive or more negative?
That's such an important question. The phrase profound changes unseen in a century, I think for some was narrowly defined as basically Xi Jinping saying, we're kicking your butt, which to me is wrong, because it's very clear that there is, I think, a extraordinary difficult balancing act that Xi and Beijing is trying to achieve with how they're assessing the international order right now. On the one hand, you do see them talk about, I think with some pretty acute frankness, growing challenges. They talk more about chaos in the international order, instability in the inner order. I almost see a bit of a shift from a schadenfreude of a shift in power from the United States as a declining power to now a little bit more hesitation. I think on the one hand, that's because they assess that the United States will lash out. And indeed, I think that's, if you were to summarize U.S.-China relations from Beijing's perspective, they just say, United States couldn't handle the growth of China. The United States is now a declining power. So they're lashing out to try to constrain us. But I think it's clear that they're very, very worried. All of the kind of low-hanging fruit of growth have been tapped. The international environment for Chinese overseas investment is no longer and technological acquisition is no longer nearly as permissive as it once was. That element, the sort of the risk side of the ledger, I think it's becoming clear they're more and more worried. Now, on the asset side of the ledger, I think Xi Jinping and I think China has this fairly organic sense of confidence about the sort of institutions that they have reformed and evolved over the past 10 or so years. We, I think, as external observers, oftentimes can't hold two consecutive ideas in our head that they are both worried and confident. And to me, the two have to be understood separate and together to get how Beijing sees us. Now, final point, I think where we should continue to watch very closely is how Beijing is looking at shifts in power over time. We keep hearing a phrase across several important policy areas and international areas where Beijing is saying, essentially, you know, time and momentum are on our side. Looking at that and how that might shift, and are we going to see a slight modification of that to where they say, maybe we don't have as much time as we thought on some of these big key issues, then I think we should start, you know, looking for the exits. But as it is now, I think it's growing risk and concern about risk in the international environment with some very, very hearty, if anything, a little bit overconfidence about their ability to deal with these problems.
Well, it's been a great discussion. Thank you for looking into your crystal ball. I'm excited to see what comes down the pike in 2022, and we will certainly circle back to you later in the year and talk about what has come up that's been surprising that maybe we didn't anticipate today. So thank you, Jude, again. Jude Blanchett holds the Freeman Chair in China Studies at CSIS. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Bonnie. Pleasure.